Constitutional Defense Council, which has been charged under HB 148 to study the situation, the potential of the transfer, and to report back to this committee on how what that potential looks like, and to prepare some legislation and some recommendations. If you break it down, there are really two major areas of assignment that we are working on in the department. The first one is to come up with proposed legislation that would create a public lands commission. And then that commission would be given responsibility to further explore the opportunities and challenges of the state receiving. Those things include things such as public safety and health, watershed protection, wildland firefighting, how we would go about utilizing energy resources on those lands, lands that we may wish to protect, perhaps to preserve in a category similar to a wilderness category, some that we would like to focus for recreation. So we are currently taking a look at what is happening in the federal government, in the state of Utah, with the public lands management agencies, what money they are spending to manage the public lands right now, and working to get a good solid understanding of what resources are being extracted and the dollars that are being extracted from those public lands. It has certainly changed over the last couple of decades. The Forest Service has nearly stopped offering or having timber sales in the state of Utah. So we know that that dynamic has changed. It seems that every time we turn around, there is a new federal regulation or guideline which further tightens the state's access to those lands and ability to continue to make a living on them or to enjoy them. Roads are being closed, mines are not being permitted, oil and gas requests for permits are taking a couple of years. There are no oil and gas leases being offered at this time, so trying to get a sense of what the revenue to the federal government is not necessarily going to reflect what revenues might come to the state. But we need to look at the cost-benefit ratios, and this will be our first crack at that. It will be in-house. We're working with the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget, the economic specialists in that office, and with our researchers and attorneys that now have some time after the filing of the RS-2477 lawsuits. So we're utilizing in-house capacity to assemble this information. I think it's important to appreciate that in addition to addressing the specifics of the bill, we need to explore the legal theories behind 148. What kind of defense will we launch, or what kind of legal assertion will we make that gives us firm footing legally before the courts? I think there is varied opinion as to whether such a pursuit would be legal or illegal. Certainly, HB 148, as it now exists, is completely legal. It directs us to assess and study the potential, and we think that is very prudent and extremely timely. We also intend to work with Lieutenant Governor and assemble a group of legal professionals, some of the best and brightest minds in the state, and ask them to join us in a roundtable to talk about what they believe would be the legal positives and maybe the weaknesses of this, so that we have a better sense of how to position ourselves and how to frame our arguments. And perhaps more important still is getting the education out to the public about what it is we are contemplating and why. Ultimately, we may find that rather than a legal solution, we are going to be seeking a political solution. And that political solution will require a broader base of support than just Utah. We're going to need Westerners, Western states, governors, and legislators to rally together to pursue this interest. And I am very pleased to report some of those activities that are underway. Next week, Western Caucus of the United States Congress has invited representatives from the state to go back and report on HB 148. That's an incredibly exciting opportunity. They are all hearing about this. Western states all have a lot in common as it comes to the challenges of dealing with the public lands and the limitations that they restrict us with. So I know Representative Ivory is going back. Again, Tony Rampton is going back. And they will be doing an in-depth presentation, not just to the caucus, but I know they're lining up many other groups that they are going to present to. Wonderful education opportunities. We are also going to be working with ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is having their annual meeting in Salt Lake City in the end of July. We are working with them to try and set a morning session on the Wednesday that they begin and have that as an opportunity for some presentations, questions and answers, and education again about what the drivers are behind 148, why we believe it is time for Western states to stand up, and why we absolutely believe that their request and in request for land transfer is very rational and very justified. So we will be meeting with that group. We have a gentleman who is a professor at the University of Maryland by the name of Robert Nelson. He has studied this whole issue of the transfer of federal lands into state ownership and management for literally decades. He's written books on the topic. We've discussed it with him. He would love to come out and help us with the presentation at that ALEC meeting and help educate and also work with us on doing a Utah-specific overview of what we might be talking about, what our challenges would be, and what the opportunities would be. So we are in a working stage, a lot going on, a lot to do. Looking forward to reporting to you further at your August and September meetings, and then to have a final work product for you in November. That does not mean that there will be a bill passed. There will be a draft bill for you to consider and other draft recommendations for you to contemplate. Representative Ivory, I asked him if he would help me display a couple of very interesting slides that I think really illustrate the challenges Western states are up against. So I'm welcoming him, with your permission, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Ivory, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the work that Kathleen and others are doing on this. There really has been kind of a Team Utah approach. I can report that we've been out to Colorado, to Arizona, to New Mexico, dealing with folks in Idaho. The response has been overwhelming. The folks in New Mexico have invited me to come back again next Monday and Tuesday prior to the trip to D.C. They're building their Team New Mexico around their specific issues. I think one of the things that's come up, that was an article just published in the Utah Policy Monday, Tuesday, the fact that this has been done before. We're not blazing new ground with this. We're simply going back over what the states in 1828 to 1854 did. And if I could, I'll just pull this up, because I think it really is very significant. This was the Congressional Public Lands Committee in 1828. And you had such notable Western states as Indiana and Illinois and Missouri and Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas and Florida repeatedly petitioning the federal government, delegations, resolution after resolution, and ultimately succeeded in securing legislation to transfer their lands. But this is what the Congressional Public Lands Committee reported in 1828. If these states are withheld, if the lands are withheld from sale, which is the effect of the present system, In vain may the people of these states expect the advantages of well-settled neighborhoods so essential to the education of youth. We're not making this up, guys. This has been done before. These states will, for many generations, without some change, be retarded in their endeavors to increase their comfort and wealth because they have not the power, incident to all sovereign states, of taxing the soil to pay for the benefits conferred upon the owners of the land. When these states stipulated not to tax the lands of the United States until unsold, they rested upon the implied engagement of Congress to cause them to be sold within a reasonable time. No just equivalent has been given those states for a surrender of an attribute of sovereignty so important to their welfare and to an equal standing with the original states. And then look at that last phrase there. A remedy for such great evils may be found in carrying into effect the spirit of the federal Constitution, which knows of no inequality in the rights and powers of the several states. That's all we're asking. It's been done before. So and there's so much more. Hopefully you're getting the email updates. There's another one that'll be out to you this morning. We're going to kind of go on a weekly that gives you a little land facts on that. But the other significant thing I think that's happened since we met, about 3 weeks ago, the Government Accountability Office, in reporting and testifying to Congress, said that there is more recoverable oil in Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming than the rest of the entire world combined. And so we've got a $2 billion education funding gap, $5 billion at risk from federally unsustainable funds, and trillions sitting right there that are at our disposal if we simply follow the same road that the 1828 states did. So very significant developments. And just one other quick slide that I think, and Kathleen, if there's anything else that you wanted to look at on this. This is one that Congressman Bishop illustrates very frequently. That the slide on the top shows the disparity in education funding, and we know the image on the bottom. Maybe there's a coincidence there. And in fact, I understand in working with the folks in Idaho that particular year that this data came from, they had some kind of an anomaly in one-time funds that put them into the yellow category, where they're struggling as mightily as we are in funding education because simply the access issue. Working very closely with ALEC, there's a number of presentations, as Kathleen mentioned, going forward there, working with a number of other states. Arizona, you know that the governor there vetoed their bill, and we met with the sponsor a couple weeks ago. They took an approach that we didn't take. They took a more aggressive approach where they didn't recognize the historic use of the land and carry that over. The grazing, the mining, the timber, the recreation, the open space. They took a let's sell off all the land approach, and the governor vetoed that. Well, we took a much different approach, recognizing that those rights and expectations have accrued over 116 years. In meeting with the sponsor, the light bulb went off. He says, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. We're gonna work on our bill, and we're gonna rework that. And they're already working to bring that back. And as I mentioned, there are folks in other states that are working very diligently to join us in this effort. Anything else that you'd
No,
want to...
I appreciate that. I think you can sense the fire in the representative here who has been leading the education front on this and reaching out to so many. And he certainly is driving the train here as far as getting others on board and really demonstrating that this has been done before. That we're not asking for something unique and different or unfair. We're asking to be treated fairly. So with that, I will close my comments and see if anyone on the committee has questions.
Thank you. Appreciate your hard work on this. Obviously something that's very important to our state and something that your office has been charged with, Kathleen, and we know that you've jumped right into it. Chairman Barris.
Thank you. And Kathleen, thank you very much for the good work that you've done in already preparing the foundation for what needs to be done here. Just a couple of thoughts. One, just a bit of information. You can add to your list of action items that are being done is that in the annual meeting for CSG West in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, later in July, the executive committee will also take up this issue. In looking at supporting a resolution for the Western states that would support this process of how states can acquire and control their public lands, if that is done, then what they will do is throughout this coming year, they will prepare in their agendas, either through the Education Committee or their Energy and Public Lands Committees, they will include this into the agenda, so there will be opportunities for information and education to those legislators that will be attending the CSG meetings through the coming year. So that presentation will be made again in the annual meeting for CSG West up in Edmonton, Alberta. The other thing that I just wanted to ask, as I've looked at this, I mean, I'm just so excited to see the opportunities that this could create for our state, but it is a big, it's a tall order to take all at once. And I'm just wondering if you have thought yet of how you're going to, as we acquire this land, I know that you are looking at putting together the Public Lands Commission. Is this something that we continue to look at and say, let's address this all at once, or are you considering phasing this or staging this at certain times, depending on whether it's Forest Service land or BLM land or whatever? Has any thought been given to that?
We have certainly given thought to a transition of perhaps 5 to 10 years to give us time to assimilate, to understand our challenges, and to make sure that we are managing one section of land well as we acquire the next. I think if we got to a point where the federal government said, fine, it's yours, we would take it altogether because we wouldn't want to lose that opportunity. And the politics in Washington can change on a dime. So if we get the right folks in town and they say, you know, you're right, this has been done before and it should have been done long before now, I think we take it on, and we are studying what kinds of management needs we would have. What would that commission need to be prepared to do? The commission itself, under the law, would then, if they once established, they would be directed to start to prepare the guidelines for management. What are the guiding principles? What are the stewardship principles? How are we going to manage those areas that have minerals? Are we going to sell them? Or are we going to lease them? And in what ways will the state secure the revenue? So there are so many questions. It may be that at the end of the day, our report to this committee raises questions that need to be pursued as much as provides some answers. But certainly there may be a need for some additional economic analysis to make sure we've got a handle on what we're doing. Clearly, the opportunities for increased funding are there. We just have to understand how to manage those in a way that serves the people of the state of Utah well and that reflects our commitment to stewardship and to protecting land for not just this, but for generations to come.
Thank you. I believe this is Representative Barris, or Representative Briscoe, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, Representative, would you be willing to put up that last slide that showed the red and yellow and the, got a couple of questions.
Certainly.
On the top map, I've seen this before, and it's an interesting statistic. Do you know whether the representative and his researchers controlled for growth of student population and looking at this differential in funding?
I haven't drilled down into the back end of his data. We do know anecdotally in meeting with all the folks throughout the West that, of course, we're all struggling tremendously on a per-pupil funding basis, and those states that have more challenges with federal control of their land seem to have higher challenges in education.
On the bottom map, looking at Nevada, which is a big sea of red other than the kind of that I-80 skating across the northern third. I'm just interested in the implication of state trust lands that were deeded to those, in Utah's case, 4 sections and a 36-section square to be used for the purpose of promoting public education. My understanding is Nevada got rid of them all. They sold away their state trust lands or traded them away very early. So the red on Utah's map and the red on Nevada's map includes, the red on Utah's map includes the state trust lands. I'm assuming that those are not zipped off that map.
No, my understanding is it's not. These are federally held lands, and so in Utah, for example, that would not include the trust lands. However, the little squares being as they are, it doesn't show up as exact on that map, given the...
I have a state trust lands map in my office, right, and there's a whole bunch of those little measles pock marks all
right.
over the state.
You know, and part
but
of that...
But there are also huge sections because Governor Leavitt and a Democratic administration traded out of the national parks
right.
and a lot of areas, and we've got large conglomerations down by Big Waters, the good Representative McNabb has pointed out to us, in other areas where we've concentrated those trust lands in areas where we believe we have economic development, mineral extraction potential. So those are not included. If we were to blow that bottom map up, we would not see those big swaths and tiny little dots.
Right, that would be the overall in terms of, you know, you've got kind of a broad swath to try to cover the major areas, but no, that's correct. That's correct. And part of, if you've talked to Kevin Carter at CITLA, the understanding is we're losing something on the order of $100 million, I think, on an annual basis, where we simply don't have access to the state trust lands that we do own because they're in-held. And so you have access issues, you have issues in terms of development for school trust and generating income off of those, because then you can't consolidate the lands and develop them on a broader basis as well. So even the lands that we do own are at a great disability simply because of access and the consolidation. Now in Nevada, I know that they had the issues with the gambling funding that they're struggling with that as well. And so where they had been in a situation where their funding was much higher than the national average, they're in a tremendous situation now and having issues in looking at trying to go back and fund. And
the in-held lands are an issue. I remember Governor Bangeter suggesting, you know, that a McDonald's can generate a lot of money on some of those trails and on some in-holding lands in Bryce Canyon, and it was a nice image to make the state's case that if you're going to manage the federal park, you do that, but give us some equal compensation.
Yep.
My last question, my memory of HB 148 was that the report that we would receive by November, the proposed legislation would include a proposal for a public lands commission. Isn't that the task of...
That is. We will have draft legislation that would create that public lands commission and address a couple of other items, and then it identifies tasks that would then be assigned to the commission for further study.
Would it be possible to see, like, you know, your thoughts on that public lands? I understand we're to receive two more reports.
Correct.
from you, and would it be possible to see what you're thinking about before we see the final legislation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll want to get your response to a draft earlier than November so that
Great.
We have what we hope is a product you can work with and start to modify officially if you choose. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to go back to Chairman Barris, and then I believe it's Representative Noel who's next. Chairman Barris.
Thank you. I was just talking with Brian, our policy analyst here, and we were going back through some of the statistics through the Apple Initiative, and what you saw up on the screen is an updated portion of that. But this information actually comes from the Department of Education, and all they're saying is they're not looking at it from the standpoint of where public lands are. They're looking at the states and their ability over a given period of time to increase public funding. And so what that is demonstrating is that the western states have not been able to fund their education growth nearly as well as some of the central and eastern states. And what we can capture from that is why, and one of the reasons is because of these public lands that are held in the western states. And so those numbers that we see, for example, the 37% that was in Utah, that just means over a given period of time, we were only able to increase our funding by that amount, whereas some of the other states have been able to do that in a much, much greater a higher number. So the corollary there is that lower education funding occurs primarily in the western states. And why? It's because of federal lands.
Okay, thank you. Might just point out the graphic that was on the screen there last does show private land, so that does address the state lands issue. The dark colored there it shows all private lands. Representative Noel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of issues here. As this bill was going forward in the session last year, there was a pretty wide group of people that were involved in almost biweekly meetings throughout the session in drafting this legislation. Kathleen was involved, and AG's office was involved. Many legislators were involved with this. One of the issues we wanted to make sure that people understood is that just like Arizona, issue with selling off the public lands, that we would not sell off all the public lands. That we'd go back more to the model that was proposed when the Federal Land Policy Management Act was put in place. This included exchanges. This included some sales of lands that were uneconomic to manage and isolated parcels of land that didn't have access that would require more monies. Some of the things that have happened since 1976 have changed the entire management structure on public lands. Representative Briscoe mentioned the BOLD initiative that Governor Leavitt initiated down in the Big Water area. That was specifically an initiative to develop the coal resources in the Andalex coal field on the Kaparowitz Plateau. So that large block of land was traded out. That would be the area where the power plant would have been built, and it was a process that would have gone forward had the National Monument not been made. So many of the things that have happened have been a result of an overreaching federal government authority that did not comply with the intent of Congress. I'm sure former BLM Director Clark would recognize that. We were doing exchanges on a very regular basis since 76. We were working with state trust lands. We were allowing access. We were allowing development of minerals. But you got cases like this one in 2010 where the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals basically said if you exchange out a piece of property, and this was with a coal operation, and I think it was Anadarko or one of the coal operations, that said that if you exchange that out, not only if you exchange it acre for acre with a trust facility, you then have to go in and determine in an environmental analysis, an EIS, what the impacts would be of the new owner of the property. Mm-hmm. So we could exchange the land out for trust lands, and then trust lands would have to go and say, hey, this is going to be more restrictive under their management scenario than it was under the federal government management scenario, which was zero development in those areas. So it's the federal government themselves that have had their rules and regulations that Congress put out and said were reasonable that have brought this upon themselves. Notwithstanding the fact that I totally agree with the representative that we should, in fact, be managing these lands. They should be done on a statewide basis. The monies that accrue to that, because of the unique sovereignty of each state, should go to our school children, should go to the people of Utah. So what has happened is the fault of the federal government, is the fault of individuals that believe they have more right to control what happens in our state, to our students, to our tax monies, they meaning people outside the boundaries of our state, than we do. And this is why we've taken this action. But we are not selling off. It doesn't impact trust lands. I want to make that perfectly clear. It does not impact existing rights that were accrued under Federal Land Policy Management Act. In other words, if people have grazing rights, if they have existing mineral rights, those are all the things that are going to have to be taken into consideration as this management change occurs. You can't just go out and zap away 110 years of public land laws and say, oh, guess what, King's X, we decided you're not going to get this grazing anymore, or you're not going to own this access to your water rights, or you're not going to own this. We can't do that. That would be acting contrary to the interest of the people of Utah that have developed these lands and that have used these lands, these public lands, for their benefit. There's millions and millions and millions of dollars tied up in people's portfolios, their individual, for grazing, for mining, for recreation, things that have happened that we've got to recognize. So it's a long process that's going to go on. It's not something that can happen. But the road that we're on, the path that we're on, with the work that Representative Ivory has done, is on a pathway that we can really feel that we've got a victory ahead in the future. And it's not just a pie in the sky idea. It is actually a reality that's going to come to play, and we need to play it out. I actually talked to someone from Arizona about this issue with the Arizona bill, and that was one of the things we determined early on in this group, we're not going to sell off these public lands because there's too much at stake here. There's too much. There's recreational opportunities. There's wildlife opportunities. There's things that are out there that we have to recognize. So I hope the committee recognizes that from both sides of the aisle, that our goal, and has been from the beginning, is to be able to get as much benefit out of these public lands, mainly, in my mind, for the school children of the state of Utah, but for the Utah people as a whole. That's the whole, that's why I support this, why I have supported it, and that's why I think it's going to be a win for the people of Utah, and I think everyone will see that, and they'll recognize that.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Anderson, is that your light that's on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ivory, I just so appreciate your leadership on this issue, and I also appreciate the education that you're doing with regards to, obviously, the political argument against this is that it'll just be thrown out in court. So I appreciate the education you're doing on that front. I just, quick question about the timeline of events. Where do we go from here? You know, when I have people ask me, where's that at? Can you just kind of go over some dates of things that are coming up and where we're going to go?
Yeah, I'd be pleased to. Thank you. The way the bill is set up, I mean, there's been much in the newspapers about $3 million to go charge the hill. Well, those were never connected. We're dealing with a wide variety of this, as this committee well knows. We're dealing with a wide variety of federal intrusions to roads, to jurisdiction, to land use, to land access. And so the $3 million that was appropriated deals with all of the various federal intrusions. None of it was allocated directly to this bill. And so what you hear in the newspapers about, you know, $3 million for this is just simply not accurate. What the bill does, the first step is, as they did in 1828, we work with our governing partner to say, look, you have a duty that goes back all the way to 1780 in the original resolutions of Congress and the Land Ordinance of 1784 and the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 that has been quoted by the Supreme Court all the way through even to and past our Enabling Act. They go back to that history and talk about the federal government holding that land as a trustee. And so step one is we set the deadline an abusive partnership, if I can use that term, until the abused partner steps up and says, hey, wait a second, we have to have an intervention here. We have to have a partnership discussion. We need a deadline to resolution. That's how we work things out. And so what this bill did is set that deadline to resolution, but step one is to engage our governing partner and see if we can't work out an orderly transfer on reasonable terms that we agree to, given that it's not 1896, it's 2012 now, with all of the things that the good representative from Kanab pointed out. If it were 1896, sell all the lands off. That's not who we are, though. That's not where we are. We have to take all of that into account. And so step one is to see if we can't, with our other Western states, engage. The reason they succeeded in 1828, they knew their history. They knew their rights. They banded together. They refused to take no for an answer. And they got congressional relief, where in 1854 they passed what was called the Graduated Price Act, where they reduced the price until they ultimately just gave the land to the states. And so now those western states of 1828, you know, the Illinois and Indianas and Missouris and Arkansas, they have 3-4% federally controlled land. At that time, they were controlled 90% by the federal government. So that's step one, is that engagement process. We begin that next week. And so we're really encouraged, as Director Clark pointed out, with Tony Rampton and others. We're going back to meet with the Congressional Western Caucus, meet with a number of other people in D.C., and begin that engagement process. At the same time, we begin to build the legislation on what the Public Lands Commission would look like. We've got a great model in Sitla where we are already managing 7 million acres and doing a very effective job. We take that as a model and then reflect some of the things that we've talked about here, where we manage for more of a multiple use and for the sustained yield. The economic analysis that Director Clark talked about, those are the kinds of things that are moving forward. And then looking at the legislation for the next session, we actually have two legislative sessions before that deadline comes to look at building the Public Lands Commission, to look at the types of sovereign actions, you know, pointed out on this unanimous Supreme Court decision that's up on your screen. They talk about the uniquely sovereign character of our admission, particularly where all of our public lands are at stake. And so one of the other factors is working with the Attorney General's office on what those uniquely sovereign acts might be, will be, to the extent that our governing partner will not engage with us in an orderly transfer of these lands in fulfillment of their duty as a trustee over these lands to be disposed at our statehood. Does that kind of start to map some of that out?
Yeah, one follow-up question, if I may. How similar would you say this very recent Supreme Court case, 2009, how similar would you say that is to what HB 148 does?
You know, the facts of that case were quite different, but the statements of law were plain statements of law. You know, to say that the consequences of a state's admission are instantaneous, well, that's just a statement of law. That's not fact-specific. To suggest that Congress can change our admission at statehood, again, that's just a statement of law. That's not fact-specific. And particularly where all of the public lands are at stake, those are just statements of law. The issue in that case was very direct. The issue in that case was Congress came in three decades after the state's admission and said, we're just going to change what you did and what your rights at admission were. Well, think about FLTMA then. We had our rights at admission were Congress was supposed to extinguish title to the land. And by the way, that language is in the Enabling Act of Louisiana, of Alabama, of Mississippi, forgetting a couple of other ones, but certainly Oklahoma, North Dakota, South Dakota. That same language, the people forever disclaim all right and title until title thereto shall be extinguished. Word for word, the same language. They've got 3, 4, 5% federal land because, again, you go back to the history and read the Supreme Court holdings on what that language meant. It meant that we gave title to the federal government. We ceded title to the federal government so that there would be no dispute in their title when they disposed of the land as they were duty-bound to do. So that those are very direct. And so what the Supreme Court said is Congress has no authority, no power, no right to change those uniquely sovereign character of a state's admission, particularly where the public lands are at stake. I think it's very powerful. That's not the only case. You go back to the Andrus versus Utah case where they say that our Enabling Act is a solemn compact. Well, that's language that pulls back then to the resolutions of 1780 into the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 that was cited all the way through even in these 1828 cases, the idea of a solemn compact. That means something more than a contract. And so that's in the Andrus case. You've got cases at the time of our Enabling Act in 1894, the Bowlby versus Shively case, where they say it doesn't matter how the federal government got the land, whether it was by the land cessions from the states where the state said, we'll let you have this land as a trustee, you dispose of it to create states. There were treaties and purchases. They said it doesn't matter how the United States acquired, got title to that land. They hold it as a trustee for the states ultimately to be created. Similar language, and if I could just point out on that, we obviously can't cover all of this here. I'd be happy to spend days and hours and weeks teaching about this because you can tell I'm kind of very interested in it. But on these websites, this American Lands Council, we're starting to migrate everything there, but on the arewenotastate.com and then on the American Lands Council, we're putting information on there as fast as we find it and research it. Senator Lee's office has been very gracious to give a couple of interns to just research the Library of Congress on this for us and help us with that. Senator Hatch's office has been great to pull information and pull things back and working with them, as has, of course, Congressman Bishop and Congressman Chaffetz. They've been very helpful in helping to find and pull together information. So you'll continue to have information there, and we'll continue to send those weekly updates that you can forward on. And if you have groups or others that we need to go teach and put together, just let me know. We're happy to go out and preach the land's gospel everywhere we can go.
Thank you.
Representative Ivory, really appreciate your passion on this issue and all that you've done to carry this issue forward. That's obvious from the standpoint of where we are. We're moving this forward, and we really appreciate that. Representative Barris.
I'm just going to make one clarification as we conclude this presentation. Representative Ivory, mentioned this American Lands Council. That is a completely independent group from the legislature. It is an independent group from the executive branch. So the fact that we might be referencing that here is nothing to do with what Kathleen is charged to do, with what the legislature is charged to do, but it is an outreach group for education that is separate and apart, and just wanted to make that clarification.
Correct. And Mr. Chair, if I could, I understand, and Director Clark could probably speak to this as well, they're putting together websites that are the state-sanctioned websites to begin to put out information on this as well.
That's correct. They're not up and running, but we are in development stage.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no further questions or comments from the committee, we're going to go to the public. Are there those from the public who would like to either comment or ask questions on this issue? Go ahead. Please state your name for the record.
Chairman Barris and members of the committee, my name is Vince Rampton. I'm an attorney at Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough here in Salt Lake City, and also declared candidate for Lieutenant Governor on the Democratic ticket. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you for just a moment, and I know your time is short, so I'm not going to make speeches. I would like to compliment Ms. Clark on 2 points. First of all, on relying on such a distinguished and renowned attorney in the Attorney General's office, is Tony Rampton, in assembling the information to present to the Congressional Committee, and also, and more seriously, in the matter of taking this matter before the Western Congressional Conference to consider a measured and rational approach to what has been done here. I do take issue, however, with the idea that this is somehow a partnership effort. The wording of HB 148 is very clear. It states outright, and I'm quoting, "On or before December 31, 2014, the United States shall extinguish title to public lands and transfer title to public lands to the state." That's a mandate from the state of Utah ordering the federal government to extinguish title to its own public lands and transfer them to the state of Utah. That's not a partnership act. That's a dissolution of partnership act. And it's a great concern to the people of the state of Utah, obviously, from the Dan Jones polls that have recently come out, to take this approach to trying to work with the federal government over federal lands that have been in federal control since statehood. I'm concerned as an attorney practicing in the area of eminent domain that this constitutes an attempt at seizure of federal lands for state use, which is not only a violation of the Supremacy Clause, but flies in the face of Utah's own eminent domain code, which requires showing that before public lands can be seized for other use, they have to be shown to be devoted to a higher public use. That's a balancing test that I believe that the state will lose, and lose very badly. That being the case, I believe that a more measured approach is warranted, and I believe that it is going to have to be a much more carefully thought out approach that will take a lot longer than the end of 2014 to implement. I greatly fear that, number one, we're going to lose this process in court and lose it hands down, because I believe that the federal agencies controlling federal lands in the state of Utah take very seriously their responsibility as shepherds and trustees of that land for the people of the United States as a whole, and not just for the state of Utah. We may have issues with that, but it's a partnership we've been living with for a long time. We need to rely on our congressional contacts in Washington to mediate and work with the federal government in that respect, and that's been done in the past, and it has worked. We need to focus on a more constructive approach rather than simply drawing lines. That having been said, I am hopeful that as the committee goes forward in its analysis and meets with congressional representatives, that a more rational and measured approach to the problem at hand can be arrived at, so that the federal lands that are currently being challenged and that we are demanding be returned to us can be managed in a more responsible and rational manner. And that's my piece. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you. Please stay. I think we have a question for you.
I beg your pardon.
Representative Ivory, is that your light?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yeah, I'd just like to kind of address some of the topics that you talked about. You know, in terms of the partnership, we have a partnership that's sick. It's still a partnership, but it's very, very ill. And in a very ill partnership, as we mentioned before, there are interventions that need to happen. We can either continue to take it, or we can do something about it. A couple of examples. Just recently in Tombstone, Arizona, the federal government came in and just shut off their water that they had for 130 years and said, "We don't care anything about your health, safety, welfare of your city, because there might be an owl in this mountain that burned out." The mountains that are burning out, by the Government Accountability's own office, own audits, repeated audits by the Government Accountability Office, say that the Forest Service is killing the forest. They're loving the forest to death. They're allowing fuel to build up, and as the fuel builds up, because they've done away with all harvesting, they've done away with all grazing in much of the national forests, they're building up fuel, and fuel does what fuel does, and it's burning out the national forest. Now, catastrophic fires where they're crown fires that are sterilizing the forests. You've got issues with the Environmental Species Act where they've recovered 13 out of 1,300 species that have been listed. They have a 0.1% effective rate, and yet they've killed entire industries like the logging industry in the Pacific Northwest, only to find out just a couple of months ago that it wasn't in fact the logging. The BLM came out now and said, oh, it was actually the barred owl that was bigger and faster and getting to the food supply of the spotted owl. It wasn't the logging at all, and so now their solution is to kill the barred owl. So to say that we've got a partnership that's functioning well, and that we're somehow not within our rights to try to restore balance to that partnership, I take great exception to. The fact that you opine that we'll lose, that's certainly an opinion. We'll certainly lose if we do nothing. And if we continue down this road, our forests will continue to be destroyed. We can't even go in and do anything about the bark beetles that are going in and destroying all of the forests. You see what's happening in Colorado, in Arizona, in New Mexico right now. You've got hundreds of homes that have been burned out, businesses burned out, because, again, that fuel load has been built up, because the idea is that an absentee manager can do a better job than those whose lives and livelihoods depend upon that resource and who are more responsive and responsible. It's been shown throughout history. So I guess I take exception. Then I would just point out that on the Dan Jones poll, very faulty information. They actually came out and said that the Attorney General's office said this was unconstitutional. Nothing is that couldn't be further from the truth. And they came out with the premise of, do you support spending $3 million for an unconstitutional challenge? And so the premise of their poll was just really bizarre. And so I guess, you know, if you ask a loaded question, you'll get a loaded answer. And so that's where they go for there. And I'd be happy to hear any comment you may have on those things.
Just as a matter of follow-up, I agree that a poll response to the questions that are asked. I've been in that business myself enough to understand that. However, the fact remains that the law needs to be applied uniformly. It needs to be applied even-handedly. I'm not quarreling with the idea that federal lands could be better managed, state lands could be better managed, trust lands could be better managed, all lands could be better managed. That's not a question. The question is how we go about it in the best way. And I believe the best way is not to declare war on the federal government, draw a line in the sand, and say by the end of 2014, you hand these back or you get sued. That's simply not the way to work. It perpetuates in my mind the vision of the state of Utah as myopic, isolationist, and parochial, which is already too pervasive in Washington. We need to promote ourselves as part of a growing and vibrant nation and not a backwater. And I believe the approach that has been taken the approach that is now clearly being taken by the commission to work with congressional representatives is the correct one, so I commend that. Any others?
Thank you. Good discussion. Representative Draxler, did you have a question for this witness?
Oh, I'm sorry. It wasn't specifically a question.
Okay.
It was more of a statement.
Okay, good. Let's wrap up this discussion with
okay.
this statement.
Okay, I just have to say that when we talk about the federal government being a conscientious steward, that at one time they may have been when we had multiple use policies. But what they've become conscientious in at this point in time is protecting their turf. In my opinion, that's what they're all about these days. I'm not going to denigrate and say they don't do anything right, that they're ruining these lands, but the problem is they've become extremely conscientious about protecting their turf, and I think we can demonstrate many ways that their stewardship has fallen, has become degraded compared to how it was at one time when it was managed on multiple use policies.
Thank you, Representative. We do have one more light on that I didn't see. Representative Noel, wrap it up with this one.
Thank you. I'm sorry I missed the gentleman's name that came. Did you say you were?
Rampton. Vince Rampton.
Oh, Vince Rampton. Yes, so Tony is your relative then?
Tony's my big brother.
Oh, Tony's your brother?
Yes.
Well, Tony's on our side, so just so you know that. I've been working with Tony for quite a while.
We've had that conversation, but it was very short.
But let me just say something, having living in southern Utah, working and understanding what the federal agencies do in that arena for 20 years, seeing what's changed since 1976, I would vehemently disagree with you and show you the policies that they have implemented that have literally destroyed our public lands. The wildfires that are occurring right now throughout the West are a direct result of their ineptness and inability to harvest timber, to reduce fuel sources, and to stop the encroachment of the bark beetle in our areas. They are totally beholden to the environmental groups, and if you talk about backwater and extremes, that's the extremes. The extremes are the environmentalists that go out and put people behind amber snails, spotted owls, and issues that have really destroyed the public lands in the state of Utah and throughout the West. So I think the people in the state of Utah have as much common sense and as much ability to manage these public lands as any Washington bureaucrat. So I'd like you to come down and show you what's happened in southern Utah, show you the overreaching authority of the federal government, taking away our water rights, taking away our grazing rights, taking away our mineral rights, taking away our access, and what's actually happening on the ground. And I think maybe the scenario that you explained might change in your mind.
Were I elected, that would be a priority trip for me. Thank you very much, Representative Noel.
Thank you. Okay, we appreciate this great discussion.
Thank you.
Ms. Clark, thank you for your efforts and for this presentation. We'll look forward to further discussions.